What if I told you that you possess a hidden internal GPS?
Oh, that's a really interesting way to put it.
Right. Welcome in to you, our beloved family, to another in-depth exploration. And today we're not talking about a GPS that you just plug a destination into.
Right, not like Google Maps.
Exactly. We're talking about a tracker that reveals exactly where you already are. Like, what if the things you worry about the most, the things that make your chest tight at 2 in the morning, are secretly acting as like a blinking red dot on a map?
Pinpointing exactly where your heart is trapped.
Yes, pinpointing exactly where your heart is currently trapped.
That is a phenomenal way to frame it, because when we analyze the source of our anxieties, we aren't just looking at, random biological stress.
Right, it's not just cortisol.
Exactly. We are looking at a highly accurate diagnostic readout of our deepest, most closely held attachments.
And that gets right to the core of our journey today. We are unpacking a truly thought-provoking sermon based on the book of Matthew, specifically the Sermon on the Mount.
It's such a foundational piece of work.
It really is. And the entire mission of this message, it basically circles around one timeless, incredibly piercing question, which is, where is your heart?
It's a question that just forces you to pause, doesn't it? Like, you really have to stop and think.
Oh, absolutely.
And what's brilliant about this sermon is that it doesn't just pose the question philosophically, it provides a very practical framework for answering it.
Yeah, it breaks it down.
Right, detailing the profound psychological and spiritual connections between our inner lives, the things we value, which the sermon calls our treasures, and the everyday anxieties that just seem to plague modern life.
Right, so the goal here for you, our beloved family, is to discover how shifting our focus can radically alter the trajectory of our lives, like how to actually free ourselves from so many of these modern obsessions.
Which we all have.
Oh, totally. But to really grasp what this sermon is saying about the heart, we have to start by looking at what the heart isn't. And that brings us to a historical group of people, the religious elites of Jesus's time, the Pharisees.
Yeah, and to understand the weight of the sermon's critique here, we really have to strip away our modern preconceptions.
What do you mean?
Well, today, the word Pharisee is almost just a synonym for a hypocrite, right?
Yeah, it's totally a completely negative word now.
Exactly. But in their actual historical context, these were the respected, ultra-disciplined elites of their society. Like, they were the people you looked up to.
Okay, wait, so they were like the community pillars.
Very much so. Yet the core of Jesus's ministry, as outlined in the sermon, was about profound inner transformation. And because of that focus, the Pharisees receive a remarkably severe rebuke.
Which seems kind of counterintuitive if they were the ones doing all the right things, right? Why were they getting chewed out?
Because they had built an entire culture obsessed with outward appearances. It was all visible religious performance.
Like they gamified it.
Yes, they had essentially gamified spirituality. They were hyper-focused on public attendance, praying really loudly on street corners so everyone could hear their eloquence, and even physically contorting their faces when they fasted, just so everyone would walk by and know exactly how pious and disciplined they were.
Okay, I want to push back on this, or at least genuinely play devil's advocate for a second here.
Sure, go for it.
Because if I zoom out, isn't it just fundamental human nature to want credit for our good deeds? I mean, let's take a modern example.
Okay.
Let's say I donate, I don't know, a massive amount of money to build a new wing for Children's Hospital. But I only do it because I want my name in giant brass letters on the front of the building.
Right, the classic naming rights.
Exactly. But the hospital still gets built, right?
Right.
Sick kids still get treated. So from a purely utilitarian standpoint, good was done in the world.
Right.
So why does this sermon treat my desire for a brass plaque as this massive spiritual catastrophe?
That is exactly the friction the sermon wants us to feel. It's a great question. If you look at it purely through the lens of civic utility, yes, a hospital was built. The kids get care. But this text isn't a manual on civic utilitarianism. It's a surgical examination of the individual human soul.
Okay.
The danger of this outward hypocrisy, what we might call virtue signaling today, is what it does to you internally.
How so?
When you perform an act of righteousness purely for the applause of an audience, you trigger a very specific psychological and spiritual mechanism.
Walk me through that mechanism. Like, what actually happens in the brain or the soul?
Think about it like a neurological reward circuit. When you do something genuinely good, you have this huge opportunity for internal growth.
Like building character.
Exactly. Developing actual humility, genuine love, real character. But the moment you do it for public applause and the crowd claps or your peers praise you online,
you get the dopamine hit.
You get the hit, and your reward circuit completely closes. You got exactly what you paid for, which is temporary validation.
Wow.
Your brain basically says, mission accomplished, and all that difficult, painful work of genuine internal rewiring just stops cold.
So it's like a roadblock.
A massive roadblock. Hypocrisy is spiritually dangerous because it prevents actual transformation. You look fantastic on the outside, but your interior life remains completely untouched and hollow.
That, man, that completely changes how I view the concept of a reward.
Mm.
The applause isn't a bonus on top of the good deed. It's a transaction.
It is entirely transactional.
And it's a terrible trade, honestly, because the applause fades the second the audience goes home and you're just left with the exact same flawed character you started with.
Precisely. Which is why true worship, according to the sermon, requires absolute vulnerability and honesty before God. No audiences, no PR campaigns.
So if your primary concern is curating your image for the outside, your inside fundamentally cannot change.
It's impossible. You've already cashed out.
Okay, so if that outward performance is a total dead end, what is the alternative? What actually drives us from the inside out?
Well, that brings us to one of the most famous and, frankly, deeply unsettling psychological insights from the sermon.
Which is?
Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Oh, right. Yeah, that is a heavy statement.
It is a profound piece of human observation, really. The sermon is explaining a foundational aspect of our wiring. Humans cannot help but follow what they deem valuable.
It's an involuntary mechanism.
Totally involuntary. Whatever you assign the highest value to your ultimate treasure, that is the exact location where your heart is going to just set up camp and build its home.
And what fascinates me here is how the sermon connects this, you know, ancient idea to what we experience right now. It suggests that many of our modern addictions, and I'm using that term in a broad existential sense, aren't just bad habits.
Right. They're much deeper than that.
Yeah. They're actual symptoms of a trapped heart.
Yes. Because when we think of addiction, we usually think of substances, right? Drugs, alcohol.
Sure.
But the sermon broadens this to mean a state of captivity. A heart becomes enslaved by a specific object, a specific pleasure, or a specific status, rather than being anchored to God.
So you literally become a prisoner to the thing you've elevated as your treasure.
Exactly. You serve it.
Which circles us perfectly back to that internal GPS idea from the beginning of our exploration. Because, you know, I love a good diagnostic tool. And this sermon basically hands us one on a silver platter.
It really does.
If we want to find out what our true treasure is, we don't have to guess. We just have to look at what we are most sensitive to. Or even better, what causes us the most immediate visceral anxiety.
That is the key right there.
Right. I was thinking about this earlier. Like, yeah. If you just track someone's heart rate when they open their banking app or when they look at their weekly screen time report, you aren't just looking at data. You are looking at a topographical map of their heart.
It is a profoundly sobering mirror to hold up to ourselves.
Okay.
Because anxiety is the smoke that tells you exactly where the fire is.
Oh, I like that. The smoke that shows the fire.
Right. So if you are constantly obsessively anxious about what people think of you at work, then social status is your treasure.
Yeah.
If you panic and ruin your entire weekend because your retirement portfolio dropped a fraction of a percent, then money is your treasure.
It's unavoidable.
It is. The sermon argues that the direction your heart points is the direction your entire life will inevitably and unstoppably flow.
But, you know, the anxiety makes total sense when you realize what we are actually putting our trust in.
How do you mean?
Well, once we identify that our hearts are chasing these earthly treasures, the sermon hits us with this massive, sobering warning. It forces us to confront the extreme fragility of earthly wealth.
Oh, the vulnerability of it all.
Exactly. We spend decades building our lives around securing these physical and digital assets. And the text basically waves a hand and says, look how quickly it all evaporates.
And to really feel the weight of this warning, it helps to step into the historical shoes of the original audience. Because in the ancient Near East, wealth wasn't an abstract digital number sitting on a server somewhere.
Right. There were no stock portfolios. There was no crypto.
Exactly. Wealth was incredibly tangible. When the sermon talks about mobs eating your treasure, it's not just talking about losing a nice sweater.
It's not.
No. In that era, expensive, intricately woven textiles were literally a form of currency. You hoarded clothes to hold on to your wealth.
Wow, so your closet was literally your bank account.
Exactly. But a tiny insect could quietly eat through your entire life savings in a dark closet.
That is terrifying.
And wealth also meant massive hoards of grain, which a bad roof or a humid season could just rot into toxic sludge.
So rust and decay.
Right. And it meant precious metals hidden in your home, which thieves could, as the text vividly describes, dig right through a mud wall to steal.
So their wealth was entirely physical, which meant it was universally vulnerable to physical decay.
Absolutely.
And honestly, while our wealth today is protected by, you know, passwords and encryption, the underlying truth is identical.
It hasn't changed a bit.
Right. The stock market crashes, inflation eats away at purchasing power, massive companies go bankrupt overnight. It's the exact same decay, just a different mechanism.
That's spot on.
And the sermon sums this up with a quote that just stopped me in my tracks. It says, "Shrouds have no pockets."
It is a devastatingly simple truth. Shrouds, the garments used to wrap the dead, do not have pockets because you cannot take anything with you.
Nothing at all.
And to drive this point into the bedrock of reality, the sermon uses a phenomenal historical anecdote about Alexander the Great.
Oh, man, this was my absolute favorite part of the material. Because here is a man who literally conquered the known world.
The whole known world.
Right. He amassed more wealth, more land, and more absolute power than almost anyone in human history.
Yet the anecdote notes that as he lay dying, fully aware that the end had come, Alexander commanded his generals to ensure that when he was carried to his grave, his hands were to be left completely exposed.
Like hanging outside the coffin.
Yes, hanging empty outside of his coffin.
Just to make a visual statement to his empire.
Yes, a deeply profound one. He wanted to prove to the entire world that even an emperor, a man who claimed ownership of the globe, takes absolute nothing with him when he crosses the threshold of death.
That is chilling.
He arrived empty-handed, and despite all his violent conquests, he leaves completely empty-handed.
It really points out the immense tragic irony of human behavior, doesn't it?
It does.
Like, we spend our entire lives on this treadmill, building bigger and bigger financial portfolios. And usually the primary fuel for that hustle is anxiety.
We think we're buying peace of mind.
Exactly. We are trying to buy a sense of permanent security. We think, if I just hit this number of my bank account, I will finally be safe.
But the sermon argues that doing this doesn't actually create security. It just creates an idol.
We have to define what an idol is in this context, right?
Yes, because an idol isn't just a golden statue you bow down to in a temple.
Right.
An idol is any object, any concept or pursuit that demands your absolute unending devotion, but possesses zero capacity to actually save you when the storm hits.
Wow. Zero capacity to save you.
None. So when you develop a pathological obsession with your wealth, the sermon states this isn't just bad financial planning. It is empirical evidence of a broken spiritual balance.
Think about how that plays out for all of us. If taking your eyes off your wealth for a single afternoon causes you genuine panic, that wealth is not protecting you. It is ruling you.
You are its servant.
Yet you aren't the master of your money. Your money is the master of you. You are working for it.
That is the exact psychological trap the text is exposing. The anxiety you feel in your chest isn't a sign that you need more money.
What is it then?
That anxiety is the friction of trying to tighten your grip on something that is fundamentally designed by the universe to slip through your fingers.
Okay, so this brings up a massive, highly practical question for you, our beloved family, and for me as well.
Let's hear it.
If earthly treasures are destined to rot or get stolen or get eaten by metaphorical moths, wait, I mean, and if even Alexander the Great dies with empty hands, what on earth are we supposed to do with the resources we actually have right now?
It's the ultimate question.
Because we live in a physical world. We have to pay rent. We can't just pretend money doesn't exist.
No, we certainly can't. And what's brilliant about the sermon is that it never suggests we should take a vow of absolute poverty or pretend money isn't real.
Okay, that's a relief.
Right. Instead, it offers a radical paradigm shift in how we view our relationship to that money. It asks us to undergo an identity shift.
From what to what?
Moving from viewing ourselves as owners to viewing ourselves as stewards.
From owners to stewards. Okay, yeah. Let's dig into the mechanics of that. What is the actual difference based on the text?
Well, the text establishes a foundational reality, which is that we are merely sojourners on this earth.
Like travelers.
Exactly. We are travelers passing through a temporary space. Life is fleeting. Therefore, logically, everything we possess, our bank accounts, our talents, our time, our energy, isn't actually ours to keep forever.
Because we can't take it with us.
Right. We don't hold the deed to it. We are just managing it temporarily. We are stewards of property that ultimately belongs to God.
So it's literally like being a fund manager.
That is a perfect modern equivalent.
Mm.
Walk through how a fund manager operates.
Well, if I'm a fund manager at a major firm, I might move millions or even billions of dollars around every single day.
Right.
But that money doesn't belong to me. My personal name isn't on the account. I don't get to take it home and buy a yacht with it.
You go to jail as you did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My only job is to invest that capital strategically exactly where the true owner wants it to go in order to generate the specific returns the owner desires.
Exactly. And when you apply that analogy to the sermon, it unlocks the entire message. When the text commands us to store up treasure in heaven, it is not talking about building a literal pile of gold on a cloud in the afterlife.
Right. That wouldn't make any sense.
No, it means actively, intentionally using your current earthly resources to do good, to show charity, to alleviate suffering, and to advance the kingdom of God right here and now.
So in this framework, sharing your wealth or giving to the poor isn't a financial loss on your personal spreadsheet.
Not at all. It is the successful fulfillment of a divine mission. You are directing the funds exactly where the owner wants them deployed.
That completely flips the script.
It does. And the sermon references a brilliant piece of philosophical advice from Tim Keller that is incredibly insightful here.
Well, what is he?
Keller points out that human beings are fundamentally lovers. Like, we attach our hearts to things. His advice is that we must make what we love the ultimate internal object.
Because otherwise it fades.
Exactly. Because if we attach our deepest love and identity to temporary things like status, youth, or money, we will be psychologically and spiritually destroyed when those things inevitably fade away.
Which they will.
They always do. But if we attach our hearts to the eternal, we find actual unshakable security.
I want to focus on that security for a second, because if my identity shifts from being an owner to being a steward, how does that practically change my relationship with the fear of loss?
That's the real test of the theory.
Right. Let's say the market crashes tomorrow, or a literal thief breaks into my house and steals my car. How does a steward react to that trauma versus an owner?
It changes the entire psychological impact of the event. If you are an owner, a severe loss is existentially devastating because your very identity, your ego, and your core security are fused to that possession.
You didn't just lose a car, you lost a piece of yourself.
Exactly. You lost your treasure. But if you are a steward, your identity is fused to the owner, not the possession.
Oh, wow.
A market crash or a stolen car is incredibly unfortunate. Yes, it's an operational setback, but it doesn't destroy your core security because your true treasure is completely insulated from earthly decay.
Your heart isn't anchored to the sinking ship. It's anchored to the shore.
Perfectly said.
That is incredibly liberating to think about. It's like a massive weight being lifted off your chest.
It is absolute freedom.
But I have to be honest, it also sounds really difficult to maintain. I mean, it's easy to talk about being a steward while we're having this philosophical discussion, but how do we maintain that posture on a random Tuesday morning when the mortgage is due and the car needs new tires?
It's where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. How do we live as these stewards without slipping right back into the anxiety-ridden posture of an owner?
The sermon actually anticipates that exact struggle, and it says that to successfully maintain this lifestyle, we require one highly specific, vital tool.
What's the tool?
The text calls it a healthy eye.
A healthy eye. Okay, I know this comes from a metaphor in the text where it says, the eye is the lamp of the body. Unpack the mechanics of that. What does a healthy eye actually do?
The metaphor of the eye as a lamp is really about focus and illumination. According to the sermon, a healthy eye is an undivided eye. It is entirely focused on a single master God.
It's like a camera lens.
Exactly like a camera lens.
If you try to focus on two subjects standing at entirely different depths of field at the exact same time, the entire picture just becomes a blurry, unreadable mess.
That is exactly it. The text explicitly states that you cannot serve both God and money. It is mathematically and spiritually impossible.
You have to choose your focal point.
Right. If you try to split your focus, your eye becomes divided or unhealthy. And when your lens is blurry, the text says your whole body is filled with darkness.
And we can interpret that darkness as the exact anxiety, confusion, and spiritual blindness we were analyzing earlier.
Yes. You lose your way because your GPS is broken.
I think it's crucial to make a distinction here, though,
Yeah.
because it's so easy for people to hear this and swing to the opposite extreme. The sermon is not arguing that money itself is inherently evil, correct?
Correct. And that is a vital distinction to make. The text never claims that physical materials or money are inherently bad.
Okay, good.
Instead, it suggests something much more fascinating. It suggests that money's true value is completely dormant until it is utilized for a higher purpose.
It's just raw potential energy, like it's a battery sitting in a drawer.
Exactly. When you hoard it out of fear, it remains dormant. It's just a digital number on a screen or a stack of paper in a vault.
Useless, basically.
Right. But when it is deployed for God's kingdom, when you use that money to help a family in need, to fund vital good works, to step fully into your role as a true steward, something miraculous takes place.
It gets activated.
Yes. Those earthly numbers are converted. The sermon describes them as being elevated and transformed into eternal heavenly credits.
It's the alchemy of generosity.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it.
I just marvel at this framing because it completely flips the script on how modern culture views success and wealth. I mean, the world screams at us every day that true wealth is about hoarding the highest possible score on earth before the clock runs out.
Get as much as you can while you can.
Exactly. But this sermon argues that true wealth has nothing to do with what you can hoard. It's entirely about how much you can effectively deploy for eternal value.
Yes. It is taking something inherently temporary and, through the intentional act of faithful stewardship, transforming it into something that lasts forever.
Mind-blowing.
The money or the talent or the time finds its true ultimate value only in the exact moment it leaves your hands for a divine purpose.
This has been such a profound and challenging journey. To you, our beloved family, let's take a moment to trace the path we've walked in this exploration today.
It's been quite a path.
We started by examining the historical trap of the Pharisees, uncovering the deep spiritual danger of religious hypocrisy. We learned how performing good deeds merely for the applause of an audience short-circuits our psychological reward system, leaving our inner lives entirely unchanged.
Right. And from there, we explored the unbreakable magnetic connection between our treasures and our hearts. We realized that our modern anxieties aren't just random stress, but highly accurate maps revealing exactly what we value most.
Then we confronted the absolute fragility of earthly security. We lingered on that striking historical image of Alexander the Great with his empty hands hanging outside of his coffin, a stark reminder that shrouds have no pockets.
A powerful image. And finally, we discussed the liberating paradigm shift of moving from anxious owners to purposeful fund manager stewards who use a healthy, undivided eye to convert dormant earthly resources into lasting, eternal value.
It truly is a complete rewiring of how we interact with our lives and our resources. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you, our beloved family, with a final thought to mull over something that builds on the profound challenge of this sermon.
I'm curious what this is.
Well, the text places a massive emphasis on the purity of our motives, famously suggesting that when we give, we should do it so secretly that our left hand doesn't even know what our right hand is doing.
Right, complete secrecy.
So I want you to imagine a scenario this week. What if you were to engineer a radical act of generosity, maybe paying for someone's groceries, or covering a significant bill for a friend in need, but you structured it so meticulously that it was physically impossible for you to ever get caught, thanked, or praised for it?
A completely anonymous deployment of capital.
Exactly. If the possibility of applause was entirely removed from the equation, would you still feel the same motivation to do it? And if the motivation vanishes in the silence, what does that reveal about the true nature of the reward you're seeking?
Wow. That is a heavy question to walk away with.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us for this incredibly meaningful exploration.
It has been an absolute privilege. Mm-hmm. Goodbye, everyone.
Take care, beloved family, and we will see you next time.